The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So sensuality, sense pleasure, is a huge topic. Desire is a huge topic. Sensual desire is a huge topic. And sensual desire as in the relationship to Buddhist practice, meditation practice, is a huge topic. So, you know, we could have gone on for a few weeks just on this topic. I think it's very important. What I hope we've done a little bit here today is to kind of open up the territory for you some, to look at, so you can become a little more familiar with some of the aspects of it. I hope that you have an appreciation for the value of sense pleasure. There's a place for it in life, a healthy place, useful place for it. I hope that you see that, you know, beginning now to see a difference between sensual pleasure and the desire for it. I hope that you see that the desire for it sometimes comes with consequences. Sometimes the consequences are immediate, where it just feels uncomfortable to have the desire. Sometimes it doesn't have this uncomfortable feeling. Sometimes it feels quite good to have it. Sometimes the acting on those desires have bad consequences. Sometimes it doesn't. A wise person is able to distinguish between, you know, when something is healthy and useful and when it's not. Without that ability to distinguish, I think there's not a possibility of a wise life. And then I hope that you begin being able to discern the impact that desire for sense pleasure has when you meditate. There are ways that desire for sensual pleasure, held just the right way, can actually support meditation practice, because if you tune in to some of the pleasure that can come from meditation itself, then tune into it and kind of allow it to kind of grow, it can keep you very present and help you with being present and help the mind become still. But also, the desire for sensual pleasure the sensual pleasure you desire has nothing to do with meditation itself, but has to do with the person sitting next to you or what's for lunch or anything else, then obviously, without it being moralistic, obviously it taking you away from what you set yourself to do, which is to meditate and be present. So if what you want to do is meditate, everyone's going to have to deal with the hindrances, have to somehow become wise about them and skillful at letting go of them, of not letting them get the upper hand. And so the last little piece of this afternoon, I want to talk a little bit about how to work with the hindrance of sensual desire. How not to have it be a hindrance. How not to have it get in the way of your purpose. And some of this, you know, we've talked about many times and talked about some of this last time as well. So some of this is going to be repeat. But there's one thing that is not repeat from last Dharma practice day. One thing which is maybe not mentioned often enough in discussions about the hindrances, and that is one of the very useful or very important supports for not getting swept away in sensual desire is confidence. To have confidence in the meditation practice, the purpose of the meditation practice, perhaps where you're going with the meditation practice, and confidence in yourself in doing the meditation practice. Because if you have a lot of confidence, inspiration, this is really important and useful, then you're less likely to be pulled away by other things, by distractions. You can't underestimate the power of distracting mind, you know, these things. It still will happen. But if you're not confident, not inspired, you know, meditation, it's okay, you know. I like to meditate sometimes. I like to collect stamps, you know. it's all good. then, you know, you sit down to meditate, then it's going to be very different if you say, well, this is, you know, really what's, I feel, you know, most important. A lot of the things I do in my life don't make so much sense. So this is what makes sense of my overall life. This is really has a high priority for me. This stamp collecting can wait. Then, I think, so confidence. So when you're struggling with the hindrances, especially with any of them, but then now for sensual desire, you might step back for a moment and not address the sensual desire directly, but address the issue of confidence. Kind of study your confidence. Do you have confidence? What do you have confidence in? Does your confidence invested in the practice you're doing? Is you have confidence in yourself doing it? If you don't have confidence in yourself, then there's going to be hesitation in doing the practice. You're going to stumble over yourself as you do it. And once you start stumbling or hesitating, other things can sneak in, and off you go. Confidence is no guarantee that you can avoid. I remember sitting the 3-month retreat at IMS, and I had tremendous confidence. Not only had about myself, the practice, what I was doing, and I had my practice was going really, really well. So the confidence was verifiable confidence. It was going great. But I was also very concentrated, and at some point my concentration was hijacked for three days by a particular kind of desire, fantasy thing to happen, and I had tried really hard for 3 days to get my mind to stop thinking about these things. It just wouldn't, because it was kind of like the concentration just had chosen that as the object, you know, one pointed focus. And so after about three, it took about 3 days to work through it. So anyway, confidence, I think, is a great, great support. I think it's great support to not be moralistic about sensual desire arising, not be uptight about it, not feel like it's a failure, you're bad because of it. It's just a part of being a human being. It comes with a human body to have it. It's just normal to have. And in some situations, it's healthy to have it. In some places, maybe not, the way expressed. But to kind of, so in that sense, be relaxed about it. If you make a bigger deal of it than it actually is, sometimes it can sometimes feed it even more, or it can have other kind of deleterious effects. So to kind of be a little bit relaxed about it, a little bit. A classic instruction around sensual desire is to reflect on the dangers of the sensual desire. So what are the dangers if you follow through on that particular sensual desire? Now, if there are no dangers in that particular one that you can see of in acting on it, one of the dangers is simply it takes you away from your meditation. Maybe that's enough. Maybe that's really what you set yourself to do. But some of them, you know, are dangerous. You know, I've been on retreat, meditating quietly by myself, and you know, the color of her socks gets me going. And you know, what am I doing? You know, you know, this is dangerous. If I follow through on this desire, you know, they're probably kick me out of the meditation center. You know, so I can see the danger of, you know, so seeing a danger sometimes is enough to sober us if it's really going down in a bad direction. One of the very powerful things to do with any of the hindrances, but I think really interesting with sensual desire, and also with the next hindrance of ill will, is to desire generally has an object, a thing that we want. And when we're involved in sensual desire, more often than not, we're focused on that object. We're living in an objectified world, the person, the food, the thing, something. And it's very interesting to just let it be the way it is. Let yourself have all the desire you want. Just let it go ahead. But then turn your attention 180 degrees around and stop having your focus be on what you're desiring, but rather feel the subjective experience of what it's like to be desiring. So turn your attention around from the object of desire to what it's like to desire. So I might really desire coffee ice cream. And I can spend all day here thinking about how wonderful it would be, and I can't wait till this is over, and why, maybe I can end the class early, you know, and you know, I can some plan, and you know, how I can make it straight through the door, and maybe use a side door, and just, because coffee, got to get that coffee ice cream. And or I can turn my attention all the way around and feel, wow, my mind is really tight. There's this kind of impulse that's pushing up through my chest into my throat. And I can feel this kind of nervous energy in my arms. And there's this also this kind of very smooth fantasy about, you know, how smooth that coffee will feel against my tongue. And all these things are present. And as I feel it subjectively, feel those things, my relationship to the desire, I think, will naturally change. More often than not, will change. When I feel the contraction of the mind, I say, gee, this is painful. I feel this upwelling energy. I feel how unstable it might feel. I feel the agitation in my arms. It's, gee, what's going on here? You know. And so when you feel this objectively, what's actually going on, it does a few different things. One of the things it does, it takes you out of the orbit of the object, the story that's connected to it. And that can be very helpful. It can also take you out of, it takes you into what the consequence is right here and now. And if the consequences have something that are a little bit painful, then if you feel that, then you kind of want to make amends. You want to change that. When sensual desire is very strong, one of the costs of it is a kind of alienation from ourselves. We lose touch with ourselves because we're so focused on the object. And it's possible to feel that it's more satisfying to be in touch with oneself than to lose touch with oneself, even though the desire we're fantasizing about is, you know, seems so nice. So this idea of turning the attention 180 degrees around and feeling what's going on here is a very useful thing to do. And probably your relationship to it all will change if you do that. The other thing to do is to develop the muscle of letting go. It's kind of like a muscle that lets go. Often, letting go, clinging and holding on, is a multifaceted phenomenon. It happens many different ways for different people, different times. But it's one way or the other, sometimes it feels like something, you're holding on to something, you're clinging to something, you're contracting on something, tightening up on something. There's a pressure or a resistance or something that's going on. And if you feel the physicality of that clinging, if you can find not just the idea of it, but if you can identify some physical manifestation of the holding in the brain, in the head, in the forehead, in the arms, in the stomach, in the chest, you know, anywhere, it's a lot easier to let go if you can feel the holding in a physical way. So you go and look around the body, look for where's that holding being felt. And if you don't feel it anywhere in your body at all, and if it's still not easy to let go of, what's going on? Where is the compulsion? Where does it reside, that powerful interest, desire, wish for something? Where does it reside if it has no physical corollary? This, you know, insubstantial, ephemeral, weightless, colorless, odorless, you know, thing that's so solid. You know, what kind of explore it and feel it. And see if you can kind of become an expert at letting go. And in this regard, it's helpful to practice the muscle of letting go. There are plenty of things maybe you don't have to let go of. There's nothing, no moral obligation to let go of a lot of things. But it's really good to practice that muscle. So if you're interested in developing that muscle, you might just kind of choose a few ordinary, simple things that you do in daily life and experiment with letting go of it and see what that's like. You know, just, you know, I don't know what it would be, but you could be becoming very simple and innocent, something you're used to every day, something that's harmless to let go of, but just let go of it and see what's that like, let go of it. And the next day, don't let go of it. And the following day, let go of it. Experiment with different ways. My experience of monastic life was one where there was, and those of you who have been on retreat, it's very much the same, there's a very high degree of letting go that's asked. Or if you're a parent, you have very young children, there's a tremendous amount of letting go that's called for there. And so sometimes comes with life situations, but also to take it on voluntarily as an exercise, an exploration, and develop that muscle. Because once that muscle or familiarity with that territory of letting go becomes stronger for you, it'll be easier to let go when you really need to. So when you have some very strong desire, the sensual desire that comes up in meditation, you can say, oh, you know, I just let go of that. And then the final thing I want to say here is that the desire for sensual pleasure sometimes is biological, physiological. You know, it's nothing more than that. It's kind of basic animal kind of thing to want pleasure in certain kinds. But also, it can be deeply tied to a lot of other issues in our lives. It can represent other things. It can be tied to other desires that we have. So, for example, my desire for coffee ice cream might not be the coffee ice cream. It might be that it's just so stressful to sit here talking about sensual desire all day, you know, and all this, and you're sitting here, and you know, and I really need to comfort myself and reassure myself that life is good, you know, because you know. That's what coffee ice cream does. It shows me life is basically good and wholesome. So it's not just the sense desire I'm looking for. It's some message that somehow comes with that sense desire. You know, in sexuality, some people, the sex part of sexuality is a minor issue for some people. It could be, for example, you just want reassurance the person still loves you. And this is a powerful way of getting it. Or the person's still there for you or something. And so you're looking for reassurance. That's part of it. Or there's power issues sometimes around sexuality. Who has the power? And so that's playing out around the desire. There is, you know, some desires, variety of kinds of desires. It's not the sensual desire that's interesting, but sometimes it's the danger connected to it. That's what's interesting. That's what makes it fun, you know. So let's just go do it in a dangerous place. So somehow that brings energy and something. Sometimes desire is not the sensual desire that's interesting, but it is the energetics. Wow, I feel alive and present. And, you know, I feel kind of, you know, normally I feel kind of empty. I feel kind of purposeless in my life. I don't know what my life is about. But give me a good sexual desire to kind of get excited about. I feel alive and present. I know what my life is about. And I better keep it going because I don't like the alternative. I feel deflated if I don't have something good going. So what I'm trying to do is lay out that, so sometimes it's loneliness that's behind. We're trying to fill loneliness. Sometimes it's insecurity. Sometimes a lot of other things going on connected to what seems like innocent sensual desire. And so sometimes what's needed in coming to terms with sensual desire as a hindrance is to understand or explore what's underneath it. Is there a deeper desire that it represents? Is it a deeper need that it's trying to fill? Does it represent something beyond just pleasure itself? And until you understand the bigger picture of it, it's going to be very hard to let go of, because the bigger picture is really where the force is coming from to keep it going and active. So that's a range of things you could do. Now, some of these things, the aspects of them, are there in the practices for the next month. It's really, I think we have five or six weeks until the next Dharma practice day. I think we're meeting on December 20th. So it's quite a ways. So there's one, two, three. There's six different weeks. Actually, you know. And for those of you interested, I would encourage you to take these exercises quite seriously for the week. Each week, take it on for a week. If you have other people here in the class you can talk to about it during that week, even better. If you can journal about it, talk to friends about it, talk to strangers about it. you know, or, you know, call up that absolutely the wisest person you know and say, you know, I was told to find the wisest person I know, and you qualify. And I would like to kind of explore this with you. Inez is one of these wise people, so you could sign up. She makes it easy. You can sign up for an interview with her to explore some of it. And then there's also a whole series of reflections. And reflections are best done by repeated reflection. Don't just read them once and think about it 5 minutes and then put it away. It's really best to reread the reflection, the questions, in different days, different hours, reread it. Let it percolate, let it move through you, and let it surprise you as you keep kind of revisiting and revisiting and kind of living with it. Okay? So we have a couple of minutes left for some questions or comments. Anybody like to... Yes, Gail.
In terms of the... in terms of the sixth sense, the mental pleasures... is there anything you can say about the relationship of that whole category of desires to all the rest of them that we've been talking about? And I'm curious as to why we haven't really talked about them a lot today.
Mm-hmm. Yes, mental desire, the mental pleasures. Well, one relationship is sometimes people are more attached to the mental pleasure that comes from sensual pleasure than the other sensual pleasure itself. They're connected, right?
Yeah.
And so sometimes it's the mental pleasure. And some people are more oriented towards mental pleasure than they are physical pleasure. Some people love to solve puzzles. Some scientists just love the beauty and the pleasure that comes from solving the difficult problem and making it really elegant. And
I'm thinking also, for instance, the desire for, to look good in somebody's eyes or to...
That's more complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not sensual desire. Sensual desire is desire for sense pleasure. And generally, wanting to look good for someone else, to make yourself making yourself such a person that you give pleasure to someone else.
Where do we put that one?
Yeah, as I said last month, not all hindrances to meditation, not all these issues fit neatly into the five hindrances.
Okay.
So you can always add sixth and seventh and eighth hindrances if you like.
Okay.
And now, some teachers will expand the first hindrance to include all desires, not just mm-hmm. sense desires.
Uh-huh.
And so it's very neat that any desire at all that pulls you away from meditation is a hindrance for the meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do that if you want, and so any kind of desire that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of kept it to the way the Buddha talked about it. I thought it was nice, some value to keep it narrowly focused on sense desires here. But some people, the pleasure, the kind of the immediate pleasure of what goes on in the mind, sometimes creative thinking is so pleasant that it's not really, you know, you're writing a great American novel. And it's so pleasant to go on thinking about it in the chapters and the plot and all that. It's just so pleasant. And we're so filled and so delighted with the rapture of that pleasure that comes from being engaged in it. And then we write down our notes and come back a week later and say, what was I thinking? So anybody else? Okay, so... I think, you know, it's basically enjoyable to talk about pleasure. And so that was, you know, I enjoyed myself. I hope it was nice and meaningful for you. And next month when we come back, maybe, perhaps, we'll do maybe a little bit checking in about this last week's about desire. And then we'll switch gears and focus on ill will, which doesn't have the same... you know, desirable qualities to it. Pleasant qualities. And we'll spend then two months on the issue of ill will. And you know, it's a very powerful force for many people. And some people, that's really much more of a significant force, hindrance, than sensual desire. And then, of course, it's very interesting how sensual desire and ill will relate to each other. You know, sometimes they're two sides, you know, they influence each other, and Yes.
Yeah, I'm thinking it came up for me today in the group on food
in the discussion of food, drugs, and alcohol is the aversion I have, and I'm not even sure aversion is the right word, but the upset I have around other people's addictions to food and alcohol, of people I'm close to.
Yeah, so aversion is a great topic. It covers a lot of different territory, and that would fit nicely in it.
Okay.
You know, in this topic, so come next month.
Yeah. So, I mean, will that be one of the
topics? I don't know if we'll talk specifically about that particular aversion, but we're going to cover a lot of aversions.
Yeah, okay.
So thank you, and I hope that any reflections and understandings and wisdom and practice you've done here today will translate directly so that your life as you go leave here is beneficial and helpful for other people. That somehow, just looking at desire itself, sensual desire itself, there's a lot of ways in which we hurt each other and cause harm in the world around us. There's a lot of harms. People feel very unsafe around this whole issue because of the harm that has been caused to them. And so as we leave today, I hope that we reflect a little bit on how we can take what we've learned today and consider how we could become safer people for the world and support this world so it becomes a safer place for everyone to live and practice. And then finally, two more things finally. I was asked to talk about dana, about donation. It's very rare that I talk about it here at IMC. But someone said there's a number of people who are new to IMC through this Dharma practice days, and so they don't know how it works here. So then for that purpose, I mention it. Everything at IMC is offered for free. It's freely given. That's kind of the inspiration we have. It's meant to be an act of generosity. We have this idea that the Dharma practice unfolds most healthily in a situation that's a field of generosity and goodwill and gratitude, and in a way that couldn't really happen, doesn't really happen as cleanly or as easily if we you charge for something. So it's how we offer it freely. And everything that gets done here at IMC, pretty much except for the renovation work, is done by volunteers. And we have a big pool of volunteers as part of the field generosity and goodwill that's really beautiful that goes on here. And for those people who would like to financially support what we do here, there is a donation box by the door. And that donation box has two slots. One says, I think it says operations, and one says teacher. And so it's your choice. You can put it in both, put it in one or the other. And if you put it in the operations, it goes to the upkeep of our center, everything we need to run it, the building and our expenses and different things. It's kind of basic expenses of running a center like this. And then the other, if we're teacher, goes directly to the teacher who's teaching that particular event. So what I'm teaching goes directly to me. And so in my situation here at IMC, this is really my livelihood. This is my work. This is kind of where I work, in a sense. So my pretty much my, you know, I don't know what, 90 or 95% of my livelihood comes from people's dana, their donation. And this kind of, you know, I teach freely, and people who want to support me, support me. So that's how it works, and there's nothing expected or nothing obligated. But if you feel moved and inspired and makes you happy to be part of this thing that we're doing here and supporting it and supporting the whole thing, then that's what those two slots by the door are about. Many, many thanks, everyone.